Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this day after Christmas with some reflections on the need for morality to infuse a new opposition movement, as it has done in North Carolina, which for the past 6 years has been under the political control of Tea Party radicals financed by a multimillionaire. With the Moral Monday movement growing by the day and making progress in reversing the damage done by the state's right-wing Republican wrecking crew and their reactionary programs and laws, we will explore the possibility of Moral Monday as a model for a national resistance movement to counter the Trump administration. With our Democratic opposition brain dead and bankrupt, we will discuss what will be needed as we face the aggressive national agenda of the political agents of the Koch brothers and other plutocrats, who will gain even more wealth as the rest of the country is impoverished further, as what is left of the social safety net is ripped out under us. First, Henry Giroux joins us. He is a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Canada and the author of America at War with Itself. We will discuss his article at Counterpunch, Militant Hopes and the Politics of the Disconnect, and why, for the most part, the billionaire class about to rule America in the name of populism wants to increase inequality and social decay and accrue even more wealth as the country becomes hollowed out and more third world. Then we will speak with Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina, who was arrested outside the North Carolina State House while peacefully demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. We will discuss the growing Moral Monday movement and the need for the Democratic political opposition to move beyond the failures of identity politics and form coalitions of diverse concerned citizenry united by what people have in common as the real enemies of working Americans in the middle class show their true face and reveal their actual agenda as the Trump administration gets underway with its ideologically driven priorities that mirror what has been tried in North Carolina. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Canada. Previously taught at Boston University and Penn State, and is the author of The Violence of Organized Forgetting and Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. And his latest book is America at War with Itself. And he has an article at Counterpunch, Militant Hopes and the Politics of the Disconnect. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Oh, Ian, I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thank you, Henry, and I wish it were under better circumstances because we are moving into the Trump era. You had previously written at Truth Out an article, White Nationalism in the Oval Office and the Suppression of Dissent. We certainly know that Trump has hostility towards the press, which, of course, essentially enabled him to get elected with $5 billion worth of free press. So it's all rather strange. But let's begin with my overall premise to see what you think of this. My understanding is that this guy is holed up in Trump Tower. He watches cable news all day, doesn't really want to do the job, has no interest in it. And meanwhile, Mike Pence is running the government. He's put the Koch brothers' cabinet together. And with an absentee landlord who's so reckless, so ill-informed as your commander-in-chief, you would expect adult supervision at the National Security Council level so that you can prevent this guy from doing something crazy with the nuclear button. And yet the people he's put at the National Security Council are even as crazy as he is, with conspiracy theorists like General Flynn and ideologues like Katie McFarland and Monica Crowley from Fox News.
No, I think that what we need to realize is that this is not just the working of some kind of eccentric sort of reality TV star. I mean, I think that what you see here is the fact that the American government has been taken over by the extreme right, a bunch of proto-fascists who are really intent on doing two things. I mean, I think destroying every institution that has anything to do with the New Deal or with the welfare state. Secondly, implementing a notion of law and order that will throw blacks, immigrants, refugees, and anyone else considered other under the bus. And I think that thirdly, you have an administration that's going to do everything it can to basically concentrate as much power as possible in what I would call the military-industrial financial elite. So there's nothing, you know, we saw this coming for a long time. I mean, this shouldn't be surprising. I mean, I think it's despairing. But the seeds of authoritarianism have been planted since Reagan took office when Reagan first took office. And I think that, you know, the end point that we've seen with the supine press, the dominance of celebrity culture in society, the inability of the left to really mobilize against this stuff and to take questions of consciousness and education seriously, and of course a right which has enormous concentrated power around the ability to shape ideological agendas, and this is where we are.
But what do you think they want, though? What kind of America do the Koch brothers want to live in?
Are you kidding? I mean, they want an America that basically is modeled after the Koch brothers' industries. That's what they want. You know, modeled after the banks, modeled after the ideology of hedge fund operators. I mean, I think this is finance capital on steroids. That's exactly what it is. It's based on a culture of cruelty, a culture of greed, self-interest, and these are an elite that float. I mean, they don't have an allegiance to anything. I mean, their sense is that economic activity and political activity should be completely divorced from social cost, and so they have no moral register. I mean, this is opportunism going berserk in the interest of both wealth and power, the concentration of wealth and power. I mean, you know, the thing that I find interesting, Ian, is that when you look at this array of people he's put together, you know, you have an alignment here of various proto-fascist elements. I mean, at one level, you have, of course, as you mentioned, you have the militarists, the generals, whether we're talking about Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, Flynn, who is basically believes that Islam is a threat to the world, Zinke, and others. So you have that element which really sees the world as a place that needs more violent military interventions, you know, and more war. Then you have the economic fundamentalist. I mean, you have Rick Tillerson, who's embarrassing, actually, as an appointment. Stephen Mnuchin, I mean, if that's how you pronounce his name, the foreclosure king. Pusda, who opposes minimum wage and worker protection, it is now the Secretary of Labor, and so it goes. And then you have the racist and the ultra-right-wing nationalists. I mean, Flynn is an anti-Muslim extremist. Steve Bannon is right out of a science fiction novel. Alt-right advocate, racist, a guy who claimed that Breitbart was a clearinghouse for a wide range of right-wing extremists, from neo-Nazis to outright racist. Then you have Jeff Sessions, who was really a trip. Here's a guy who was denied a judgeship because of racism. One said the KKK is okay, except when he found out they smoked marijuana, and supports capital punishment. Then you have the anti-intellectuals, another form of educational fundamentalism, the climate change deniers. I mean, Ben Carson is an idiot outside of his own medical specialty. Climate change denier, Rick Perry, climate change denier, wanted to abolish a department at one time he couldn't even name or remember. And then Scott Pruitt, of course, another climate change denier and a puppet of the fossil fuel industry. Linda McMahon, is this for real? Her only qualification was once that she ran the Premier Pro Wrestling League, the World Wrestling Entertainment. I mean, this is a group of not just simply stooges and incompetents. I mean, this is a group of a gallery of white supremacy sympathizers, anti-Muslim extremists, and I think what they've done is they've created what Trump has done is created the perfect storm to put into power basically all those people that he sees represent his own ideology.
And again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, who's a writer in the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Canada. Previously, he taught at Boston University and Penn State and is the author of The Violence of Organized Forgetting, and Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. And his latest book is America at War with Itself. And he has an article at Counterpunch, Militant Hopes and the Politics of the Disconnect. But it's hard to understand that the 1% of the 1% who've done so well over the last few decades, and we know income inequality has increased exponentially and will increase even further under Trump. It does make you wonder what more they can do with the money. You can't sail two yachts at the same time. And then on top of that, do these people, are they comfortable going to fancy restaurants and stepping over homeless people sleeping on the grates outside on the street?
My response to that is the very question presupposes they have a moral conscience. Uh-huh. My argument has been for a long time, and is now a lot of social science literature, that basically is justifying this. These are psychopaths. I mean, these are people who live in a surreal reality. They deny questions of truth. They have no empathy for other people. They basically travel in very incestuous circles, and they talk to each other. And their concern is not with justice. Their concern is with injustice. And I think their concern is not about simply accumulating a lot of toys, whether we're talking about 2, 3, 10, or 20 ships, or whatever you want to call them, planes. I think they're concerned about power. I mean, at one level, I think they're concerned about amassing as much power as possible. But I think at another level, they're also very, very intent on destroying democracy. Democracy is a threat to them, because democracy means you have an informed public that is capable of holding people accountable. They hate people who are critical thinkers. They hate an education which defines itself as a public good. They hate elements of the welfare state that suggest that people can be organized around shared responsibilities rather than shared fears. And so I think that what you have here is you have both, the element of greed, which you've mentioned, and its horrible consequences. And I think you also have ideologues who basically see the world in very black and white terms. I mean, who take no prisoners, who really believe in the friend-enemy distinction, and really see those elements of democracy that we at least have seen withering in the last 30, 40 years in the United States. They see them as an enormous threat, and they want to get rid of them. And they'll do as much as they can to do exactly that. I mean, America, as I've said recently, is a war culture. I mean, these are people who are militarizing almost every aspect of society. You know, whether we're talking about militarizing the police, there's paramilitary forces, or whether we're talking about investing more and more in an enormous war machine, or whether we're talking about militarizing the criminal justice system so that more and more behaviors are criminalized and the incarceration system, mass incarceration, expands. I mean, what's to come is unimaginable in my estimation. And I think that what's sad is that we did not have the formative culture available that would educate people to be able to recognize that capitalism and democracy are not the same thing. So that when capitalism failed, there was a retreat from what they thought was democracy into authoritarianism. And I think that's the tragedy.
Right. They traded freedom for sacrifice. In other words, we were told
absolutely
that we had to sacrifice because of this deficit, this abstraction.
Yeah.
And of course, everybody has to tighten their belts except those people at the top. So, but how going forward, though, Henry Giroux, the people that voted for him, a lot of white working class people, as it happened, and of course the Democrats did not even talk to them, so that's not entirely surprising. They at least somebody talked to them, Trump, even though perhaps it ends up being a complete fraud. What happens when he doesn't deliver on their expectations?
That's the hope. I mean, that's the opening. I mean, I think the opening is around the contradictions between his own attempts to define himself as a sort of, liberal populist, if you will, and all of a sudden the fact that everybody he surrounds himself with represents all the things he was attacking in the first place. And then you'll see the cuts in Medicare, the attack on Social Security. What people are going to see is that the very things that basically are able to barely sustain them are going to be taken away. And I think that's where we have to talk about making education central to politics itself. That's where both people are going to really have to struggle to provide alternative visions and alternative narratives. We need a different story about America. You know, we need a story in which democracy matters, but then we need a story that defines democracy, not in terms of the nonsense that neoliberalism defines it by, or the hedge fund managers, or the, you know, people like Trump who simply talk about this kind of stupid, rugged individualism and the notion that self-interest is the highest of all ideals. These are all Ayn Randians. Right. I mean, these are people who really believe that any kind of empathy is a curse. And I think that there's got to be a way to resurrect a sense of shared responsibility and compassion as long as people are fragmented, as long as they don't have a frame of reference by which to be able to recognize a language in which they can see the conditions for their own oppression, we're going to be in trouble. So this struggle that's going to take place in the next few years around vision, around possibility, around hope, around strategy, is really a struggle of ideas. I mean, what we have is we have a political disaster not matched by a crisis of ideas. It's matched instead by a crisis of fear.
But when you talk of the Ayn Randians, like Paul Ryan and these others, Republicans, I wonder how deep this ideology really is. Because at the end of the day, and Mike Pence is a perfect example, these people are the whores and hirelings of the oligarchs, specifically the Koch brothers in the case of Mike Pence. So isn't it sort of logical in a way that if you're a whore and a hireling and doing the bidding of somebody that's powerful and you're just some craven tool, don't you want to dress yourself up in some ideology because you can't face the fact that you're a complete sellout?
No, I think the ideology that they dress themselves up in, or will dress themselves up in, is what Paul Ryan does. I mean, this is not a new narrative, right? I mean, it's about the virtues of freedom, and freedom collapses into the discourse of the free market. I mean, that's their ideology. And of course, that's one element of the ideology. The other is, I mean, listen to a woman like DeVos, who says that education is something that she's involved in because she answers to the kingdom of God. You know, I mean, these are also religious fanatics who, even if they have to employ any morality at all, seem to think they're acting in the name of Jesus, which is really ironic, right?
Nice.
So I think at one level, I think that this question of being powerless, but somehow recognizing they need to justify that at some level, even for themselves, that ideology is already there. I mean, except for the Bannons of the world who basically simply would speak in not so coded terms about the virtues of white supremacy, I mean, these are people who are going to talk about the free market system and how that is democracy, and that they're really pushing the frontiers of individual responsibility and their uplifting moral character and all that stuff. I mean, that's exactly where they go, and that's exactly where they're going to go when they try to defend this stuff. Remember, since Reagan, I mean, what we have seen since Reagan, basically since 1980, is we've seen an argument that suggests that evil is about character. That's what it's about. You know, it's not about systemic causes. It's not about fundamental institutional problems. It's always about character. And I think that they'll use, when they talk about themselves being white Christians, or they talk about how they've got to take care of the blacks in the cities because they're out of control, or they talk about a drug culture, which is a black culture. I mean, this is basically the discourse of white evangelical extremist Christianity. That's what this is. They'll couple that with a market logic, and there you go. They've got a sutured ideology to start throwing out at the public like parrots. Now, did you watch the interview between Paul Ryan and CBS?
The 60 Minutes one, you mean, Tucker?
Yeah,
indeed. It's.
I mean, there it is. I mean, yeah. That was unbelievable, right?
Yeah.
I mean, here's a guy who basically is as cruel as you can imagine, given the way he wants to gut every social service in the country. And what is he talking about? He's talking about addressing the needs of workers by, in fact, giving them more character. And denying almost any question about what kind of program you're going to put in place if you destroy Obamacare. Well, we'll think about that.
Right.
We haven't thought about that. That'll come later. You know, I mean, it's a discourse of obfuscation and displacement. That's what it is. Always surrounded by abstract ideals that have no bearing on reality.
Well, that's the same as Walmart, this Walton family that own about their wealth is the equivalent of the entire combined wealth of the 40% of the lower end of the American working spectrum.
Right.
That's 40% of our population. They have more money than 40% of our population.
Right. Well, 400 families have as much money as half the population of the United States.
Right. So, but what do they tell their workers? Oh, instead of paying you, we'll give you a fancy title, you know, assistant, associate, etc. You know, I mean.
But I want to go back to the way you were going with this contradiction, the question of contradictions, because I think it's enormously important. I mean, I think that what I heard you saying and what I agree with is that the contradictions will now become so great that you're really going to have a fight between people who believe in democracy and people who don't. That's where the dividing line is mm-hmm. going to be. And it seems to me like when you look at the Black Lives Movement, when you look at, you know, these students endlessly mobilizing on campuses now, when you look at the way in which churches and synagogues are starting to realize that the anti-Semitism and the hate, the logic of the toxic discourse of hate, you know, it really takes a terrible toll on people. I mean, I think we're going to see more and more people speaking directly to these issues in which they're not going to retreat into balance, or they're not going to retreat into being utterly depoliticized by claiming that politics is something somebody else does. I mean, I think we've seen a withering of civic literacy in the United States around a number of areas. The public and higher education have been under assault. We see it in the media, which has become an entertainment center for idiots, the mainstream media. But at the same time, we also see the rise of alternative media that are becoming more and more popular among young people. We see people not only addressing things like police violence, but linking that violence to larger structural issues like poverty. So what I see is an emerging politics of connection. And I think that this is the most favorable thing I've seen in a long time. So you know, what's happening in North Carolina, for instance, is not limited to North Carolina. I mean, you really have to understand that in terms of a larger sort of set of circumstances that are happening all over the country. You know, right-wing governors trying to take away the power of people, you know, and doing everything they can to attack unions, public goods, schools. This is a pattern. And I think what needs to be done is this pattern needs to be capitalized upon, built upon, expanded, so that people have a vocabulary in which they can recognize where the true conditions of oppression lie, and so they can be moved away from thinking that it's really about Mexicans, illegal immigrants, or it's about Syrian refugees, or it's about terrorists. The real terrorism is domestic terrorism, and that comes from state terrorism, and that's something that has to be pushed.
Well, it's interesting you should bring up North Carolina, Henry Giroux, because our next guest is a member of the Moral Monday movement down there. And I think in many ways the Moral Monday movement could become the model that we can build upon nationally, because for the last 6 years, the North Carolinians have had this crazy Tea Party government, which we're about to get at the national level. So it might well be a model to build on.
No, I agree. And I think the one thing about that model is that it's comprehensive. It's not a single-issue model. Do you understand?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's not just about lowering taxes. I mean, it's not just about saving public schools. Those models are going to fail. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we can't situate these issues, single-issue movements, into a larger comprehensive politics, it's over.
Right.
It's basically over, because what you need is a model that's going to be able to mobilize different groups so that they're no longer fragmented and can begin to come together in a much broader and powerful social movement. You need a third party. I mean, people forget Bernie Sanders won 22 states. He's a democratic socialist. We need to change the language.
Right.
We need a language for democratic socialism, not a language for capitalism, a language for democratic socialism.
Right, and get away from identity politics and recognize what we have in common, not what divides us.
I think we need to do two things. I mean, we need to recognize that differences matter, right? They do matter. I mean, people do organize. Blacks are organizing around assault on black communities. But what we need to understand is that we strengthen those differences when we understand their limits politically.
Mm-hmm.
When we say we're fighting for a radical democracy and not just fighting for the end of racism or police violence,
Right. Then
we can see what we have in common. Then we can recognize that if you believe in democracy, then you can't support ecological devastation. If you believe in democracy, you can't support poverty. If you believe in democracy, you can't support police violence against minorities of class and color. That we need a language to join these movements. And if we don't find that language and we don't create that movement, we're going to lose.
Well, Henry Giroux, I thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate
okay,
it.
Okay, Ian.
And,
my pleasure.
And I hope you have a happy Christmas and a happy holiday.
Oh, you too.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Canada, and previously taught at Boston University and Penn State, and is the author of The Violence of Organized Forgetting and Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. And his latest book is America at War with Itself, and he has an article at Counterpunch, Militant Hopes and the Politics of the Disconnect. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina with somebody who has been arrested protesting on behalf of children and the poor. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a member of the Moral Monday movement who was arrested in front of the North Carolina State House for protesting on behalf of children and the poor.
Jazz! Words try and throw.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Charles Vanderhorst, who's a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases. His writing has been published in the Washington Post, The Guardian, Swimming Magazine, Endurance Magazine, and The Independent Weekly. And he was arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peaceably demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be back again.
Well, I've called you, Charles, because, you know, in celebrating Christmas, and of course people are anticipating January the 20th when we have a new president. But in many ways, I hate to say this, and I suspect, I suspect I'm accurate, that what's been going on in North Carolina for the last 4+ years is a precursor for what we're going to experience nationally under a Donald Trump administration. In other words, right-wing ideologues in control of the levers of government, exercising their power ruthlessly and with ideological zeal. So have you guys down there been a kind of test case for the dark side of American politics?
Well, I like to think so, in the good and the bad. So the bad, as you know, is that 6 years ago, the Republicans gained control of the House and Senate in the North Carolina legislature with funding from Art Pope. They targeted the 21 districts where the percentage of the Democrats had over the Republicans was less than 5%. He spent $2 million total for those 21 districts, and they flipped 19 of the 21, gaining a supermajority in both the House and the Senate. And then that was at the time of the 2010 census. They then were able to redistrict, and whereas previously, and we know in all the elections in North Carolina in the last decade, about a little over 50% of the voters tend to vote for Democratic candidates. But before that had been the split in our U.S. congressional districts, about 50-50 Republicans, Democrats. After the redistricting, that split to 10-3, so only a quarter, less than a quarter of the U.S. House representatives from North Carolina were Democrats, although 50% of the voters voted for Democratic candidates. So, and then 2 years late after that, the Governor McCrory, as a Republican, was elected, and then they've had complete free reign then. And it's been really stunning what they've done. Going down to messing in local small issues, city council elections, school board elections and districts, trying to take away the water authority from the city of Asheville and the revenue from that, because Asheville is a very liberal community. And so it's been sort of a reign of terror, going down to individual people, including someone in the legislature or governor's office calling up the dean at the medical school and complaining about me after I got arrested. But I believe you don't give up hope. So I know that most progressives in the United States are completely demoralized, shocked, stunned. They don't know what to do next. They can barely watch. They were glued to watching the Rachel Maddow show before, and then they've stopped doing that now because they can't bear to face the bad news. But I think that is the wrong response. I think the country as a whole is gradually getting better. We no longer have, absolute segregation. We don't have lynchings now. So I think it's important to move forward and stay in there. And I think there's reasons for hope. Do you want me to give the reasons for hope?
Well, I do, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today. As, people have celebrated Christmas, and as I say, I wouldn't say we're looking forward to the new presidency, but we're certainly expecting the worst, at least I am, just based upon the billionaire cabinets, the incredibly dangerous ideologues and conspiracy theorists on the National Security Council, which make you very, very insecure about the very security of the planet, the fact that they are all hostile to global warming. You've got an oil man, a Secretary of State, who's with his fellow oil man, gangster in Russia, Putin, together. They're just going to drill, baby, drill, and forget about the biggest issue facing the planet, which is global warming. So there's some extremely dark prospects ahead. But just before we get into to tomorrow, Monday, and my senses of what you're doing and what's happening with the opposition down in North Carolina could be the model for what needs to be done at a national level here for despondent progressives to get up off their backsides and take the country back from this minority, by the way. Again, it is a minority government that we have with Donald Trump. He's almost 3 million short in the popular vote. So
instead of the baby Jesus giving you this stuff, hope, it's this old Jewish bald guy is going to give you hope here on Christmas. So first of all, I think... You said it right about people getting off their tushies. So it's so easy for people to sign petitions on Facebook, clicking like when they see a funny joke and things like that. That is just so lazy and anti-intellectual and is never going to do. So progressives may feel good by, posting things on Instagram or social media, but I just think it's dumb. So what you got to do is, so first of all, in North Carolina, the law protects people. So in North Carolina, the courts, both federal and state, have declared more than 8 of the bills passed by our legislature as unconstitutional, including redistricting, the voter ID law, seizing appointments away from the governor, redistricting local municipalities and school boards, attempts to take over the water authority in Asheville, that was just yesterday, and providing access to state government documents. So those, and constantly, but it costs money to file those lawsuits, because this isn't the government filing lawsuits against the government. This is various legal groups, so the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the ACLU, Southern Environmental Law Center, the abortion rights folks, the gun regulation folks. So all those things take money. So give those of you who have money, give money. Those of you who don't, volunteer for them and help raise money. The news is important. So in North Carolina, it seems to me the Raleigh News and Observer, it's getting thinner and thinner every month. But every time they publish an article, someone goes to jail. So they have a crack investigative team. But newspapers are not making money on ads anymore, classified ads or, you know, car ads anymore. Where they make money now is on subscriptions. So that means buy a subscription. Don't get your news free. So that, you know, in our case, it's the News and Observer, the New York Times, the Washington Post, L.A. Times, whatever. Buy a subscription. Give your children and grandchildren subscriptions as well. So that's what I do. My children, I get them subscriptions to the News and Observer, and I have a subscription myself. Three, vote. So, you know, register voters. You can register voters year-round. Get, 20 voter registration forms from your local county board of elections, get a clipboard, and just bring it with you wherever you go. So I bring it, like, I swim every morning with a swim team. I bring it into the locker room. Some new young kid shows up, and I ask him, moves into town. I say, are you registered to vote? They say no. I give it to him. I'm giving a lecture. At the end of the lecture, I say, are you registered to vote? The students raise their hands, said no, then I can register them right then and there. So register votes. If you can't do that, then give money to the groups that do register votes. And those can be charitable donations. So there are groups that are nonpartisan that register voters. And I think a huge mistake is that progressives have a tendency to focus on presidential election every 4 years and maybe the Senate, but not beyond that. So the House, the U.S. House and State House legislatures, they turn over completely every 2 years. And remember, the Democrats only have control of, I think, 18, maybe 19 state legislatures, and we have a census coming up in 4 years. Those states will be locked in the Republican if we don't flip those state legislatures. So in North Carolina, we flipped four of the Republican-held seats in our House 2 years ago and another one this year. So, and that's going in the face of Republicans winning everything in all the other states. So how did we do that? Well, we have a House caucus that's very targeted. It only gives to folks, Democrats, who are running in districts that are within 5 percentage points in terms of polling, and they look at recent polling. Then they say, well, those are districts we can flip. Or if it's a Democrat in a seat that's in danger of losing it. So they give to that, and they can pool resources then. So they can pool the media person, the polling person, et cetera, and get advice and share advice, so it's cheaper there. And they require the candidates to come up with matching dollars. So that's how we flip seats, whereas other states that didn't happen. So the other thing is you can then people are going to be affected negatively by the policies in these conservatively led states and in the federal government. That's Muslims, LGBTQ, transgender, African-Americans, Hispanics, women's groups, immigrants, etc. So those groups, there are various nonprofits that work to protect those groups, seek out them. My wife and I are transferring the bulk of our money and savings and checking accounts that we have with Wells Fargo that is, you know, has a big stain on it now, to the local Latino credit union, and they can give out loans to vulnerable people then, when people of means, like, you know, my wife and I are both physicians, and so we are of means, and so, that others should do that as well. And then two other things, and I'll stop here, that help identify candidates to run for local offices. So, again, everyone focuses on the large elections, but we need to identify young, telegenic, smart, progressives, male, female, et cetera, to run for public office, where they don't start running for U.S. Senate or U.S. House. They first run for the school board or the planning committee or the city council, etc. So, you know, convince bright young people to start a career of public service so we can identify and help them get street cred and then run for those largest office. And then finally, in North Carolina, as you said, I was arrested 3 years ago. And you say, well, what does that do? Well, we have the Moral Monday movement. It's led by Reverend Barber, who's a Baptist preacher, but it is an all-inclusive group. So we've got, you know, old white Jewish people, we've got Muslims, we've got atheists, we've got black Baptists, white Baptists, Presbyterians, undocumented people, labor union folks, environmentalists, and we focus on the key issues. We don't focus on distracting issues. For instance, one huge distracting issue that can split progressives is to talk about Israel and Palestine. So that's not a good issue to have in this kind of movement, because it's going to split people who should be allies. So I think you focus on the key things, you get together and you protest, and protesting is important because it gets publicity. So why do people know, why does North Carolina end up on the front page of the New York Times like every week? It's not just the behavior of our state legislature, it's that the protests expose this kind of behavior. So otherwise, it would be done in the dead of night, and no one would know about it because the press is stretched thin. But when you have, 5,000 people banging on the doors of our Senate, and 20 people getting arrested, et cetera, that gets good publicity, and people see the egregious behavior that's going on. Because these are not, even though the legislature says, oh, these are paid outside agitators, no, they're actually old white, religious people, and young college kids. So they're who live in North Carolina and pay taxes, and they're unhappy with what's going on. So that's my recipe for good hope for the new year and changing things as we move forward.
And let us take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina Center for Infectious Diseases. And he was arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peaceably demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. And we're talking to him because North Carolina has, in effect, been at the leading edge of ideological Republican governance, and the Moral Monday movement might well be a model for the rest of the country in terms of progressives having to reverse this authoritarian right-wing tide that's sweeping across America.
You need it, that's for sure. Wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, who's a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina Center for Infectious Diseases. And he was arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peacefully demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. So just in terms, you've given us a wonderful digest of in effect, our marching orders to get out there and not so much make America great again, but make America just again and fair again and smart again. And this is in the environment, as I say, of a Trump administration that's likely to be a national mirror, if you will, of what you've been experiencing down there in North Carolina for the last 6 years. As you pointed out earlier, Charles, it all began with a local multimillionaire, Art Pope, who decided to put up his own money and buy the legislature, the House and the Senate down there in North Carolina, and eventually the governorship, get the trifecta, and then institute a bunch of laws that are very much in the interests of plutocrats and their political agents, like the Republicans are apparently in the legislature down there. But this is a mirror, I think, of the country. I mean, you have a Donald Trump has more billionaires in his cabinet than anybody in history. George W. Bush only had millionaires. This guy's got billionaires. He ran about draining the swamp, but it looks like he's delegated the entire cabinet to Mike Pence, and who, of course, is very much a agent of the Koch brothers. So you have a Koch brothers cabinet. So what you've been up against is, I don't want to characterize Republicans as all like those Republicans you have in the legislature down in North Carolina, and the outgoing governor who vindictively stripped the incoming Democratic governor of much of his powers in a sort of secret stealth legislative session late at night, which was just the height of partisan pettiness. And of course, and the dysfunction of these Republicans that just a week ago they couldn't even repeal this ridiculous bathroom law that's caused the state so many problems after promising to do so. So I don't think that they represent at least the Republican Party that I remember, you know, that they're more like the Tea Party crowd. And in fact, I've seen a couple of their, I think it's the Speaker and perhaps another member of the legislature was on television recently justifying or trying to justify this stripping the incoming Democratic governor of all of his powers. And it was just like just a sort of thuggish, smug fraternity boy with contempt for everybody and just, you know, relishing his kind of thuggish privilege. I mean, really a deeply unpleasant person. And this seems to be and so many of these people in Trump's cabinet, the EPA guy is similar to that. These are people, you know, that are hostile to the very government department that they're supposed to oversee. I don't understand that, do you? I know that they're bought and sold by the oligarchs, so they're essentially whores and hirelings. But why are the Republicans, this new group of Republicans, so ruthless? And why are, at the federal level, the Democrats appear to be sort of gutless, or at this point they've just sort of had the wind kicked out of them?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the underlying thing is they don't, I think it's a combination of greed and they don't believe in government. I mean, they don't believe in public education. So on the federal level, you have a woman who is, you know, an heiress to, is an Amway, I think.
$5 billion worth.
She's never been to public school herself. Her children have never been to public school. So she knows nothing about public schools, and she doesn't believe in it. We had a similar thing here in North Carolina, where these folks do not believe in public education. So that's sort of a fundamental basic concept that you would think a government would believe in. So public education, it's in our state constitution to guaranteeing children a good education at a reasonable price, and including college in North Carolina. But they don't believe in that, and so that makes it difficult. They don't believe in environmental protections or regulation of any sort. They certainly don't believe in health care for all. So these things that progressives take for granted, these people don't believe in. So there's this very sort of selfishness to it. So there's greed. They want more money. So it's sort of hard to believe, but the rich want to get really, really rich. And so cutting taxes is really important to them. So I know some of these people because I'm a wealthy guy as a two-physician family. So I meet these people. They think, I have sort of relatives, they think it's perfectly okay to evade all U.S. taxes, even though the sewers to their homes, the electrical infrastructure, the water infrastructure, the public schools they went to, these were all paid for with public tax dollars, defense, health system, in terms of research and protections with vaccines and things like that. That's all paid for with public money. These people don't want to pay to support that. And that goes to corporations, too, like Apple and Google, et cetera. The goal is not to pay taxes. And so they want to shrink government. They don't, and they want to get richer. So there's no belief in the concept of public service nor of the greater good. And if you don't have that, then it's hard to talk to these people and reason with them if they don't understand that if we don't have good tuberculosis surveillance, TB surveillance, you can end up with drug-resistant tuberculosis spreading to anybody, regardless of wealth or race or religion, etc. If we don't protect the environment, you can get severe asthma just like poor people can get severe asthma. So there's no understanding of that we're all in this basket together. And when you don't understand that, then it's really hard to have a conversation. So many people don't realize that the Richard Nixon, besides giving us Title IX and for women to get equal funding for athletics and colleges and schools, that he also founded the EPA, established the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and he also established the revenue sharing program, which, because he understood and his cabinet understood that there were wealthy communities and poor communities, and that poor communities needed good sewers, need good water pipes, need good schools, etc. But they, because all that stuff was paid for by property taxes, they wouldn't have the money to do it. So he set up a system to do revenue sharing, and millions of dollars were transferred from wealthy communities to poorer communities. Well, Ronald Reagan got in his revolution got rid of all of that. So that's how you end up with Flint, Michigan, with lead pipes and 1,800 children having brain damage because of chronic exposure to lead, high lead levels. So this kind of contract that we have with each of us that those folks don't understand.
Well, you brought up Richard Nixon, and I mentioned a little while ago that I don't want to cast a broad brush here against Republicans, because Nixon and more traditional Republicans are certainly nothing like this new crowd that have come in with the Tea Party, and they're in this new Trump government. You mentioned EPA, of course, he's a Tea Party guy, and the reason I'm talking to you, Charles, is because you're down there in North Carolina, and you've had these people in government now for 6 years, and they behaved in an outrageous, thuggish manner, but you're fighting back. You're a part of the Moral Monday movement, and frankly, I think the progressives and the Democrats and the political left in this country have got to wake up and get aboard a national version of the Moral Monday movement to start fighting back, because these people are bullies, and they're just the whores and hirelings of the plutocrats who've bought this government. And you know, this is supposed to be a democracy, and frankly, it does feel like, you know, one of the first targets, as you mentioned, with Betsy DeVos, the new education secretary, is to continue the dumbing down of America, which seems to be a prerequisite for oligarchical rule. I can't for the life of me understand why the power elite in this country wants Americans to be stupid, but perhaps in a cynical way, it's their way of maintaining power. And as Donald Trump himself said, I love the poorly educated. So just in the last few minutes, there's a wonderful video of Justice Souter, who resigned from the Supreme Court or retired from the Supreme Court about 5 years ago. He made this speech up in New Hampshire about his fears of civic ignorance in this country, how, quoted Thomas Jefferson saying, an ignorant people can never be a free people. And he predicted that if civic education and the lack of an understanding of the role of government and civic ignorance continues in this country on its current trajectory, that sometime soon, in 5 years, which is about now, somebody's going to come along, a demagogue, and say, I'm going to fix everything. Of course, that is the cynical part of the Tea Party Republicans. They are both the arsonists and the fire brigades. They create the gridlock, they make the mess, and then they have their guy on a white horse come in and say, I'm going to fix everything. So in the last minute or so, now that I've depressed everybody, turn it around, if you will, Charles, and give us the kind of pep talk we need, since you guys down there in North Carolina, I think, are showing us the way.
So, well, I sort of elaborated all the ways to do, and I think we've shown that, yes, how bad it can get, but we've also shown how you stop it. So, you know, legally we've paid. So I'm a member of the NAACP North Carolina. I'm, you know, a white, old white Jewish guy. But I joined it, as have thousands of other people in North Carolina, not just African Americans. And we did that, and we've succeeded. So we pay for the lawsuits that have overturned nine laws. We're going to have, in an off year, in 2017, we're going to have congressional elections, U.S. congressional elections. Why? Because the court said the districts were unconstitutional. They said surgical precision of racist districting was the quote from the federal judges in the circuit court. So they threw it out. So we're going to have extra elections this year. So we've thrown out, I think, 8 or 9 state laws through these lawsuits. We've helped create a massive boycott of North Carolina by businesses. Millions and millions of dollars have been lost in the state by, and particularly this is a sports mad state, and all the NBA, the
NCAAs,
the Atlantic Coast Conference, they've all pulled out their finals from North Carolina. That's millions of dollars, and thousands of jobs are lost with that. And that hurts the state and the business community, and it's going to get the Chamber of Commerce things. And we won. We defeated the Republican governor. Donald Trump won. The governor lost, the attorney general candidate Republican lost, the auditor lost. So all those people lost elections, Republicans, who should have won, but they didn't, because we were organized in the Moral Monday movement. We pay for the lawsuits. We protest and draw public attention to it, both nationally and statewide, and raise money to defeat these terrible candidates. And that's, you're right, it has to be done nationally. People have to subsume their own little petty differences with different groups. So, you know, there may be African-American Baptists who don't like gay marriage. Fine, you don't have to agree on everything, but join us on this overall issue that's going to benefit African-Americans, Baptists, and not. Same thing. Jews and Palestinians don't agree on much, but they both don't like discrimination. So let's join together. We'll discuss the fate of Jerusalem another time. But let's keep our eye on the ball, and that's defeating and these terrible right-wing folks and preventing bad legislation.
Well, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Charles Vanderhorst. He's a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina Center for Infectious Diseases, and he was arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peacefully demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.